Welcome to the Sports Medicine Podcast, brought to you by the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology at Texas A&M University. At the Huffines Institute, we're always working to facilitate, apply, and bring you the most up-to-date coverage of the wide world that is sports medicine and human performance, all in a language you can understand and share with your friends. And now, here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Well, hello and welcome to the weekly edition of the Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Tim Lightfoot, and I'm so glad that you took the time to download us and be with us today. As we strive for every week, we have another interesting person in the world of sports medicine and health with us this week. We're pleased to welcome Dr. Weston Porter to the podcast this week. Welcome, Weston.
Tim, thanks for the opportunity to come here and talk to you today, and I look forward to it.
Yeah, well, you're more than welcome. Wait until you say you look forward to it before you're done. Yeah. Let me tell the audience a little bit about Dr. Porter's background. He has a PhD in toxicology from Texas A&M University. He is currently an associate professor here at Texas A&M, works in the Veterinarian Integrative Biosciences Department, works quite a bit with the toxicology. I believe you're chair of the toxicology group here as well?
Yes, I am. I've been chair for the last 3 years and probably about another year to go.
You don't have enough gray hair yet for that.
I am. I'm starting to get more gray hair all the time.
Dr. Porter's research interests are in the transcription factors in mammary gland development and breast cancer. Works quite a bit with environmental influences on development of breast cancer as well. And so we thought we'd have him come on today and talk about his work and how it applies to everybody in the real world. First of all, how'd you get interested in cancer research and breast cancer research?
Well, during my I received my PhD here at Texas A&M University with Dr. Steve Safe, and during that my studies here, we began working and just happened to be using breast cancer cell lines as our model system. And so just in the process of doing my doctorate work, I became more and more interested in breast cancer, but I had always had this interest in cancer from my undergraduate degree in genetics and looking at different types of developmental processes. And so when I started doing my postdoc, you know, at that point it was a where am I going to focus my research, my interest for the rest of my career? And,
Always a good question.
And so I really began focusing more on breast cancer and eventually led to my interest also in mammary gland development and associating those two together. And so it's really become a pursuit of mine. Mm-hmm. However, you know, we're starting to branch into some other areas too that's not directly related to breast cancer, but we believe has a lot of similar studies that we think we can bring those two together.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned something, just to clarify for the audience, you're talking about breast cancer cell lines.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about that model. I mean, are these just kind of you randomly pluck cells from people, or how does this work?
Well, back in the 70s, there was a lot of interest in understanding, how can we determine how, cancer progresses. And mm-hmm. so researchers began developing cell lines. And what these are researchers or clinicians were taking samples from human patients with breast cancer and began putting them in these plates with, we have this media that's got all the concoctions of different factors and things that these cells can grow. So mm-hmm. we're basically able to grow these cells in these little plates with this media on top of them and put them in incubators. And what that allowed us to do is to use these as kind of a model system where we can manipulate the cells both genetically and also use them to screen different new chemotherapeutic drugs. Mm-hmm. And so it became a very popular model to look at how to look at genetic pathways that are disrupted in breast cancer and also to develop new therapies. And now there are hundreds of these different types of cell lines that represent all the different types of breast cancer that's out there.
Hmm.
And, of course, this has expanded to other cancer fields too, but it's a very powerful model system. In addition, what's great about these models is that we can also take these same cells and put them into what we call immunocompromised mice, and so we can use what's called a xenograft model.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can also use these in a mouse model to look what the in vivo effects are. So it's a powerful model system. It does have some limitations, but it's probably one of the keystones in the cancer research field right now.
So these are direct cells. Do they live forever?
They don't initially, but what we sometimes have to do is, one of the problems with the model is that mm-hmm. we have to, in essence, transform these cells. So we do have to genetically manipulate them many times to get them to grow in the plate. So mm-hmm. that's one of the problems with the cell line model system is that they don't really truly recapitulate or mirror what's going on in the human tumor.
So the idea is, if you have these cells from humans and you can find things that kill these cells, and these may be maybe treatments for breast cancer or other cancer models, if you can kill these cells.
Right, and that's really any drug that first started, tamoxifen, raloxifene, all the initial anti-estrogen drugs, some of the new PARP inhibitors, all that are in human trials right now, all started as an initial screen using these cell lines. Mm-hmm. And so as a first line, they're ideal for that. Mm-hmm. And so they're a very powerful tool that we use in the laboratory today.
But it must be difficult to go from the cell to the whole human.
Right. And so that's one of the big leaps. And mm-hmm. so, you know, the next step is generally you go to a mouse model they get spontaneous tumors, or we've engineered a mouse to get a breast tumor.
Mm-hmm.
The new popular model now is taking instead of using a cell line, is taking an actual breast human tissue sample and putting that back into a mouse and regrowing the tumor in a mouse. And it has some limitations, too, because of immune problems, because you have to use a mouse that doesn't have a proper immune system because it'll reject it. But that is the flavor of the month right now for in breast cancer field, is use that now as a model system, because what you can actually do is take one person's tumor and spread it out over, let's say, 200 mice, and now you can treat each one of those mice with different chemotherapeutic drugs and say which one is going to work, and now we can go back to the human patient, and now we know which one to use.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's turning out to be, that's I wouldn't say a flavor of the month, but it's one of the directions that we're heading in. That's actually turned out to be extremely powerful.
Yeah.
One, because we don't have to manipulate the tumor like we do in our cell lines.
Yeah. Well, you've talked about mice now quite a bit. Do you ever get back into humans? I mean, are you just really interested in mice, or are you interested in the human side of things? Or
I'm more interested in the human side of things. You know, we're here at Texas A&M, we have a very strong the vet school where I'm at, we have a very strong animal component, so we use a lot of mouse models because it's a great model system to develop in.
Right.
How we get into human patient samples, translating this over into humans, is we have a lot of colleagues that we're collaborating with, both at Baylor College of Medicine down in Houston and the University of Kansas, where we're taking human patient samples and correlating what do we see with our mouse models and our cell line models.
Mm-hmm.
Does this mirror what we're seeing in the human patient samples as far as progression from normal breast all the way into invasive breast cancer? And so that's how we work with them. And then we'll have to collaborate with them further if we want to take this even toward, you know, probably as a prognostic indicator or as a possible drug target.
Right. We all see a lot about breast cancer awareness, but you know, those efforts are often fall short when they really don't tell you what's going on with research.
Right.
So, well, I know your research is really exciting, which we'll talk about. What are the most exciting overall changes in the field that you see coming down the road? What are things that are happening now in the field of breast cancer research that are exciting to you?
I think that our understanding of what some of the initial markers that are taking place in cancer, and we spent one of the things in the breast cancer field, that we spent an inordinate amount of time looking at the late stages of the disease. So you think about, let's say breast cancer, let's say an individual that's diagnosed with breast cancer and they're 60 years old or 70 years old. Well, they probably actually started having those initial tumors back about 20 years before. And the only time that you first notice it is at 70 years of age. And so you're at the very end of that tumor. You know, it's to the point that it's very invasive. And we have targeted the last 30 years on that last 5% of that tumor's life, how long it's been there. And so the idea is we need to figure out what's happening earlier. And if we can catch an earlier stage, it's that much easier. So understanding what are some of the risk factors involved. Is it obesity? Is it physical activity? Is it, the type of your diet? What all does that have an impact on that final, your risk? And I think in understanding also the genetics of it, you know, you're more predisposed or not predisposed. If you have a certain genetic makeup, do you need to stay away from this type of diet? Or do you need to make sure that you're eating a certain or taking a certain, let's come up with a new chemo preventative approach? And I think that's probably the most exciting aspect of it right now. I think that's going to be at least as far as preventative. The other aspect of cancer, breast cancer, is really the personalized medicine of it, is that, we're understanding that cancer is not, there's not just just don't have breast cancer. You know, there's multiple subtypes, up to 32 different subtypes of breast cancer.
That was going
to
be my next question. So there are these all these different types of breast cancers. Huh?
Right. And so if you understand, you know, how you treat one can actually help another one, you know, and that's bad. So if you can understand that personalized medicine, that allows you to, you know, really treat it. Now, you know, there's always the idea of can you cure cancer? And hopefully we can, you know, in the future. But really, if you can manage it as a disease, like diabetes, you know, and keep it under control, that's another aspect of it, I think, that's going to be coming. That's actually, you know, in evidence now. We're finding that women are living much longer because we're able to modify the treatment as we see fit. As the tumor transforms, we're understanding, oh, now we need to change it to this type of treatment. And so I think those are the two big areas that's really becoming much more there's a lot of excitement in those two areas right now.
Let's talk a little bit about your work.
Okay.
You do you mix genetics with the breast cancer work.
Yes.
You've done work with a gene called SIM2.
Mm-hmm.
For our audience, tell us a little bit about SIM2, because it's an exciting story, because it's more than just involved in breast cancer, it appears.
Well, SIM2, it's a gene. Well, the name of it is single-minded. Two. And if you ever...
So a gene can have a mind?
A gene can have a mind. So there's... in the way they get... genes are named.
Right.
You know, they all have different names.
Right.
And it depends on which field you come from. Right. So if a gene is initially identified in the fruit fly field, they usually have a lot of fun names about them. Ours is called single-minded two. There's other genes called hedgehog. Other genes called... armadillo, you know, and they all have little names to them that's generally linked to their function. And so single-minded, when they knocked it out in Drosophila, it had one lobe of the brain, so they said it's single-minded.
Okay.
Well, single-minded, too, in humans is very interesting in that it was initially identified in what we call on chromosome 21 in an area that's designated the Down syndrome critical region, so of chromosome 21. So... as if you're not aware, that Down syndrome is caused by, normally you have two copies of each of each chromosome. Well, in Down syndrome, what happens is that there's a partial or a complete or partial replication of the chromosome 21, and that, of course, gives you the Down syndrome-like phenotype. And it doesn't have to be the whole amount, but just a portion of it. And, and SIM2 is right in the middle of that. And it's thought to play a very important role in the Down syndrome, in etiology of Down syndrome. And now, an interesting thing, now, what? How can I relate Down syndrome to breast cancer?
Right,
how, where does this come about? Right. Well, we got interested in this is that genetic diseases have been closely linked to different types of cancer. That's how, for instance, hereditary breast cancer genes 1 and 2, BRCA1 and BRCA2 are linked. They're hereditary genes linked with breast cancer. But interesting thing about the Down syndrome population is that they have a very unique tumor profile. They have an increase in leukemias, but they have a 50% decrease in all solid tumors. This includes prostate, colon, lung cancer, skin cancer. But the interesting thing is that they have zero breast cancer. Matter of fact, it has they're about 20 times less likely to get breast cancer compared to the rest of the population. And the reason they've been seeing this is because of increased medical care. Individuals with Down syndrome are living very normal lives now. And so and the idea has been is that there must be a tumor suppressor gene or genes on chromosome 21 responsible for
something
that.
Something there that's knocking those
right. So if you've got two,
down,
three has got to be even better. And so what we've identified is that SIM2 seems to be a tumor suppressor gene. We find that it's downregulated in human breast cancer patients. And then if you lose SIM2, you end up getting breast cancer, both in our mouse models and in our cell line models that we work with. So we're pretty convinced this might be one of the major genes involved in this.
So just to recap, so if we have if this gene is turned down, the risk for breast cancer goes up.
Right.
And if it's knocked out in the animal models, in the cell models that you have, then certainly you have breast cancer that develops.
Exactly.
And so we're thinking that may be, or you're thinking that may be the case with humans as well.
Right, and that's what we're seeing. We're finding in our human breast cancer patient samples, we can compare normal breasts to cancer that's in progression to invasive metastatic breast cancer, we find that it's lost mm-hmm. as those tumors become much more progressive.
So does something turn SIM2 off, or is that SIM2 normally turned off in people, and that's why that happens, or how does this progress?
You know? Well, we have a couple of ideas. One, yeah. we've got some genetic models. We have some genetic targets of genes, oncogenes, which are genes that cause cancer. We know when they go up, they can actually turn SIM2 off, mm-hmm. and so mm-hmm. we think it might be, you know, a consequence of that. And two, in an area that, you know, has gotten us into other fields, we've discovered that SIM2 is also repressed by high-fat diet. So if we give mice a high-fat diet, or even our cell lines, we can feed them kind of a high-fat or a polyunsaturated fatty acid, that it actually suppresses SIM. And so we think this might give us a link. It might be an actual target for dietary effects on breast cancer.
So okay, to make sure I get this straight. So if we eat a high-fat diet, mm-hmm. that may turn down, turn down SIM2,
right,
which could cause an increase in breast cancer or other solid tumors.
Or it could predispose you for breast cancer. We haven't looked at the other tumors.
Make you more likely to get breast cancer.
Exactly. And that's, we actually see that in our mouse model, that we can do that. We can take mice that are missing one copy of SIM2 already and feed them a high-fat diet, and we actually start to see an increase in breast cancer in those mice.
So are you willing to make the speculative leap that the increase in breast cancers that we've seen over the last 30 years may be due partially to diet?
Actually,
the increase in fat in our diet?
Actually, there's quite a bit of data out there to show that. You know, that there's a huge dietary association with cancer, specifically with breast cancer. I think some of the best studies that have been associated are individuals that are living in Japan, Japanese, that then moved to Hawaii, and then Japanese Americans in San Francisco. Same genetic makeup, but as you start increasing and go to an American diet, you see breast cancer rates progressively increase as you start taking on a Western diet. And a lot of that has to do with our, you know, what we're eating, the high-fat diet. And there's a huge relationship. They believe that there's studies that up to 20 to 30% of all breast cancer cases are direct relationship to high-fat diet.
So your work with SIM2 really is the mechanistic key. That's how it kind of, maybe a way how it works.
Possible, or one of the mechanistic keys. I wouldn't say it's the only one, but I think it might be one of the ones that's definitely involved.
Yeah. Now, for the audience, you should understand most good scientists are very hesitant to speculate like we've been doing. And as you can tell from Weston's last response, this is actually a major finding that's had actually really good coverage, and he's still very hesitant to say that it's real important, but it probably is. What you've talked about also kind of gets us into the preventative side.
Right.
If we eat a better diet, that can help prevent some cancers.
Right, right.
What are some other prevention things that you would tell people about to help them prevent the occurrence of some cancers, like breast cancer and prostate cancer?
Well, I think the number one thing, of course, with breast cancer is your diet. You know, risk of obesity. That's probably one of the major factors involved with that. Two is physical activity. Physical activity is direct related to not only obesity, you know, there's a relationship with obesity and physical inactivity. And you can be, don't have to be necessarily obese, but physically inactive, and that can also increase your risk also. So there's this relationship there. Now, the mechanism by which, you know, physical activity works, that's a big black box.
Right,
not too many people, actually, there's a lot of people working on it, but nobody really knows what's actually causing that. The other is a relationship with not only with diet, physical activity, but also you've got genetics involved too. That you just, you know, that's going to be something that you got to take into account with those two. But there's also smoking that's involved. There's also where you live. Just being in, you know, in certain areas of the country, you know, depending on, you know,
so environmental exposure.
Environmental exposure is going to play a very, you know, large role. Living near a freeway, for instance, you know, you have, you know, there's a relationship there that the individuals are starting to come into, that a lot of research is starting to point toward. So there's a lot of environmental effects that clearly play a huge role in cancer risk.
Okay, so now we've had several people just drive off the interstate. so this means if you live near an interstate, you're more predisposed.
Well, there is some evidence to suggest that, you know, exposure to PAHs can play a big role, and polyaromatic hydrocarbons, I say, that, you know, from the exhaust.
Okay.
So you're being exposed to, you know, there's the relationship with PAH exposure and cancer risk.
So what if you run along a street? I'm sorry. For those of us that are runners, we'll stay away from that. One of the things that we try to do is help people understand that all scientists aren't serious all the time, that mm-hmm. there are things that happen. What is your favorite anecdote about what's happened in the lab at some point during your career?
Oh, well, some of them, I probably have to change names on some of these stories.
It's amazing how many people say the same thing, isn't it? Either that or say, we can't say this on anything that's going to be broadcast.
I think the best thing that's happened to us is that one time we had an incubator go down in our lab.
Okay, so and most so people think of incubators as you're trying to hatch chickens.
So it's basically these cell lines that we grow our cells in, and we had these cells in our these incubators, and they got to keep everything at a certain temperature. Everything, it's just like keeping your eggs, mm-hmm. you know, everything nice. And what we found I walked in one day over a weekend, and one of the incubators had completely gone out.
Mm.
And I was just like, oh my gosh, you know, we just lost all this data and, you know, all the cells. So we're checking the cells, which one lived, which ones died. And as we were going through there, and this was during my graduate career, I found one of the cells in there just happened to be alive.
Hmm.
And I was like, what is different about these cells than anybody else's? And as we started looking at it, we found that it had a certain genetic aspect of it.
Hmm.
And that led to an idea of about one particular gene that was regulating growth.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was one of those serendipitous, you know, things that something broke. And it led us to an idea of, you know, hey, here's something there's a gene that's doing something that we had no idea that we thought it would normally do.
Yeah. Cool story. That's how science works, isn't it? More often than not, and that's what people don't understand, is those kind of things happen, and that's really kind of a cool story.
But the one that's probably happened the most recent for me as a professor, went down to the laboratory about 2 years ago and opened up the incubator again, and normally we have these cells growing in what we call phenol red, so it tells us what the pH is, and so the cells should be nice and red, and it was bright yellow. That generally means that your cell should be dead. And so I called the student in there, and I was like, you know, what's going on here with these cells? And he's like, oh, no. He says, I took care of those. They're fine. And I said, well, there's something going on here. And so we checked the next day, and sure enough, it was doing the same thing. And what it was is we're finding that there was a very, you know, what we called a metabolic shift with those cells, and it was something that was real exciting to us that has now turned us into a different direction. It was just an observation, you know, very simple observation that could tell us, you know, which direction we're going to now start going.
So have you started hanging out around the incubator now?
Yeah. Yeah. I go down there every day just to see if I can get any inspiration from the incubator.
New ideas.
So, any new ideas. Yeah, so,
you know, incubate your ideas, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So we're running short of time.
Okay.
We always ask our guests to give us a take-home message. What is the one thing you want people that are listening to this to remember?
Well, when you're thinking about cancer risk, you know, there's a lot of people out there that are saying, you know, there's, you know, you got to be careful of, you know, what you eat, you know, but realize that, you know, the body actually has a very nice system to inhibit cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's everything in moderation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's make sure your diet's fine, make sure you're physically active, and everything else will take care of itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, We've spent a lot of years looking at cancer in numerous ways, and that seems to be the area that as we learn more and more, it comes home to what your grandmother always told you: everything in moderation.
Right.
And it's the same thing with if you treat your life that way, and that's generally the best way that you can live your life.
Simple take-home message for a complex topic.
Exactly.
Always a good thing. Thanks today for being with us.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to speak.
We've enjoyed having you on today, and we've enjoyed having all of you listening today. And for those of you that are waiting with anticipation about the T-shirt question, here is our producer Cheryl with that question.
Which gene is being shown to be involved in breast cancer?
Excellent question. Be the first one to send us the correct answer via email at huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu, and you'll win one of those nifty podcast T-shirts. And don't ever think you're too late to respond. You know, we've been known to give out more than one shirt in a week. So send us that response. Again, thanks, Weston, for being with us today.
Thank you, Tim.
And again, thank you all for taking the time to download us and be with us. We hope that you join us next week when we have another interesting individual from the world of sports medicine health with us. And until then, we want you to be active and healthy.
The Sports Medicine Podcast is produced by Cheryl Marek and Kelly Selman and licensed by the Huffines Institute at Texas A&M under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. You can share it as much as you want, and you can talk or blog about it all you want. Just don't change it or charge money for it. This podcast is made possible by support from the Omar Smith family and the Sydney and J.L. Huffines family. Our music was composed, performed, and graciously provided by Dave Zeltner Productions, your source for quality music and music production since 1992. Find them at www.davidzeltner.com. Our opening and closing credits were provided by John Miles Productions at johnmilesproductions.com. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.